Welcome to Pause for the Cause, the official podcast of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Conference Education Fund, where we take on the critical civil and human rights issues of our day as we work to save our democracy. I'm your host, Kanya Bennett, coming to you from Washington, D.C. Today on Pod for the Cause, we are joined by three amazing guests. I need to flag that these are all former colleagues, so I can truly attest to the fact that they are amazing, they are great. These are good, good folks that we are going to hear from today. We have Jeff Robinson of the Who We Are Project. We have Kevon Ward of Where Is My Land? And we have Keenan Keller of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. So I want to give a little framing before we dive into this conversation. We're going to be talking about Juneteenth. We're going to be talking about reparations largely. So today, as we commemorate Juneteenth, now a federal holiday that acknowledges the June 19th, 1865 beginnings of emancipation of enslaved people in the United States, we're going to have a conversation about reparations. Black people in the United States continue to feel the impacts of slavery today in the form of structural racism, violence, and discrimination. And this looks like disparities in education, employment, housing, healthcare, the criminal legal system, and all of the policies that touch our daily lives. The country's racial reckoning that was spurred during the pandemic in the wake of the senseless police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor elevated these discussions around reparations. Calls were made to advance federal legislation, H.R. 40, which was first introduced in 1989 and would establish a federal commission to examine the impacts of the legacy of slavery and recommend proposals to provide reparations. At state and local levels, we have seen serious attempts at reparations and success around land returns for Black people who've had their property and generational wealth stolen by the government. So all these things point to some traction and some real opportunity around reparations. And Jeff, I want to start with you. You're the historian here. Talk to us about the origin story of reparations for Black Americans. What was this promise of 40 acres and a mule?
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast. In January of 1865, it was pretty clear that the North was going to win the war. And the Secretary of War and General William Sherman met in private with 20 free Black men in Savannah, Georgia. And what they were meeting for was to figure out, okay, what happens after the war ends? And because they thought they were doing something important, they actually wrote down what they were talking about. And there was a 67-year-old minister who answered one of the questions that was posed. What do your people need to take care of themselves? And what this minister said was, what we need is land, and we're going to work it with the women, the old men, and the children, because the young men are going to offer their service to the government in any way the government needs their service. And we will work this land until we own it and can call it our own. General Sherman was so impressed that 4 days later, he issued Special Field Order 15 that many Americans have come to associate with 40 acres and a mule. The mule actually came later, but that 40 acres to freed enslaved people, we're talking a swath of land that went from coastal Georgia all the way down into what is now the state of Florida. And when Lincoln was assassinated, President Andrew Johnson rescinded that order, and that land was taken back. But the issue of land for enslaved Black people, that was understood before the war even ended. What was understood was that our people had slaved, literally, to build this country and were owed something. That's where 40 acres and a mule came from. And the sort of horrific end to that story started 3 years earlier in the Homestead Act, because the government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest to white European settlers. And they continued to do that. I think by 1900, there were more than 100 million acres of land given. And as Dr. King noted, it wasn't just the land. It was land grant colleges. It was county agents. It was low interest rates to mechanize their farms. And then it was subsidies not to farm. And as he so eloquently put it, and those are the people telling us to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps.
Thank you so much for that history lesson, Jeff. It's so important that we have that foundation to build upon as we have a conversation about reparations modern day and what that looks like. So, Keenan, I want to invite you to give us a little history lesson as well. This one around H.R. 40, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparation Proposals for African Americans Act, which was first introduced in Congress in 1989, first by our former boss, the late John Conyers, and now Representative Sheila Jackson Lee. So, Keenan, talk to us about the beginnings and the legislative history of this more than 30-year-old bill.
So thank you for that question, Kanya. And it's so great to be on this podcast with friends and colleagues as we work toward the enactment of H.R. 40. So H.R. 40 was introduced in 1989 by John Conyers. And his inspiration for the introduction of this legislation went back to the question of compensation for Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II. Going back to the early 1980s, there was legislation introduced to study modes of compensation for those persons who were interned, which was actually supported by the Congressional Black Caucus. And that study legislation was passed. There was a commission to study different options for compensation reparations for Japanese Americans. And then it actually happened in 1988. Mr. Conyers then, who had been working with individuals around the historical African-American reparations movement, then introduced legislation the next year that was patterned on the process that led to reparations for Japanese Americans. Going back to that time in 1989, people thought that this was another one of Mr. Conyers' marathon legislative proposals, like the Martin Luther King Holiday Bill, which he introduced shortly after the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And it took time to actually build momentum around H.R. 40. Every year, he started having conference sessions at the CBC's annual legislative conference on an annualized basis to actually get those individuals who were part of the reparations movement together to create a groundswell around that issue. And I came upon the scene of all of this in 1999 when I started working for Mr. Conyers. By the time we got to the early 2000s, we had actually grown from a handful of original co-sponsors to dozens of original co-sponsors to now working with Representative Jackson Lee, approximately 200 co-sponsors of the legislation. Everyone, you know, knows that you have to get to the magic number of 218 to pass legislation here on the House floor. And we theorized that we had probably approximately 215, 217 positive votes on the floor. H.R. 40 went from being something that was a highly theoretical notion in 1989 to a very live legislative proposal that was endorsed by all the Democratic presidential candidates in our last presidential election cycle in 2020. That sort of begs the question, as we move forward, what it will actually take to get H.R. 40 across the finish line and adopted and enacted in some form, which is something that I think we can talk about, you know, a little bit later on in the podcast.
We will circle back to that, certainly, and appreciate you for laying this foundation here. As you and Jeff note, I mean, there's precedent for reparations. There's precedent for the study of harm, of oppression, of marginalization that has come to different communities in this country. You mentioned H.R. 40 now being this live legislative proposal. And so, Kavan, I want to talk to you about where there are other live legislative proposals at the state and local levels. So you're based in California, and I know that you are working on land reparations, land return. You are in the reparations fight. So can you talk big picture about what is happening right now in California? And if California might be the model, might set the tone for what is to come with reparations nationally.
Thank you, Kanya, for having me. And great to meet you, Keenan and Jeff. There's a lot happening in California. A lot especially has happened since the return of the land to the Bruce family. So I am the advocate who championed the cause to get the land back to the Bruce family. So that's what Kanya means when she talks about me being involved with land reparations. But in California, as you know, there's this task force to not only study what reparations would look like, but also speak to recommendations for the state. The one challenge I see with the task force and the recommendations is that because the bill can't really focus on race-based remedies, they decided to create this lineage-based remedy where if you can prove that you are a descendant of an enslaved person, then you would qualify. But when I testified before the task force, I stated why I thought that would be a problem because it's extremely divisive. And what we don't need is Black people being pitted against descendants of enslaved people. I have testified that I think that it should be harm-based. The remedy should be harm-based as opposed to lineage-based because, you know, one of the things I realize is that when folks discriminate against Black people, they're not saying, well, you're from Jamaica or you're from Africa or you're from here, so therefore we're going to treat you differently. They treat us all the same. And so the remedies for how we're treated, how we've been treated, should be for everyone. Right now, they're still working on getting recommendations from the public. And their report is set to be sent to the governor at the end of June. They'll be making some recommendations and the governor will decide on what to do later after that. But it's been a very long ride for this task force. I know it's a challenging job. I don't envy anybody in those positions, but I do have some concerns as it relates to who is going to be compensated for the harms against all Black people.
Jeff. During the racial reckoning of the summer of 2020, we were in the early days of the pandemic. We had a lot of attention focused on the police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, as was noted at the top of this conversation. There were lots of conversations about the oppression and marginalization of Black people and how to make Black people and Black communities whole. So reparations became a serious part of this conversation, as we've touched on. The following summer, though, after President Biden was elected, we saw Juneteenth become a federal holiday. While folks were pushing for H.R. 40 at that moment, we got Juneteenth. So I first want to start again with a little history around Juneteenth, Jeff. Talk to us about the significance of making this a federal holiday.
And I hope that Keenan will correct me if there's any place where I am wrong on the sort of legislative history, but the celebration of Juneteenth, to put it in very simple terms, there were enslaved people in Texas that were still enslaved. The war was over. The Emancipation Proclamation had been issued. They were still enslaved. And a northern general came down and said, oh, hey, by the way, the war is over and y'all are free. That's essentially the story of Juneteenth. And what is interesting to me is that from May 30th until June 1st, 2021, the entire country was riveted by what was happening in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We were dealing with the 100-year mark since the Tulsa massacre. Many Americans, for the very first time in their lives, were hearing about this horrific story. And America was not only fascinated, but America was horrified. I kind of call this a naked lunch moment. The author William Burroughs, when he wrote the book Naked Lunch, he was asked, what does that title mean? And his Beat Generation co-writer, Jack Kerouac, had come up with the title. And he said, it means exactly what it says. It's that moment when everyone has to look at what's really on the end of every fork. And America had a naked lunch moment with our history of anti-Black racism from May 30th to June 1st in 2021. 16 days later, without any prior work or any prior discussions, Congress passed a law making Juneteenth a holiday. 16 days after the things that were going on in Tulsa to make us reckon with our history. And I did as much research as I could. And what I found a couple of years ago is that it cost approximately $450 million to shut down the federal government for one day. Now, there's a Republican senator who recently claimed it's $600 million. And so I don't want to debate, $450 or $600 million for one day. So what that means is that Congress in 16 days decided we are going to spend between $4.5 and $6 billion over the next 10 years to give Black Americans a holiday. I am glad that Juneteenth is a holiday, but that $4.6 to $6 billion over the next 10 years, don't tell me that we don't have the money for reparations. We have it. It's just a matter of the will to move forward on it.
Can I add to that? I just want to say, this is not even really a holiday just for Black people. White people get that day off as well.
The concept of a Juneteenth holiday had been floating around for a while. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee and Senator John Cornyn, both of Texas, had been very actively working together and discussing this, because Juneteenth had historically been Texas observance, because it was directed at the experience of enslaved African Americans in Texas. The family history of Black Texans, this was something that was known, it was celebrated, and it resonated with Texans. The interesting thing about the Tulsa anniversary and H.R. 40 as legislative proposals were that these were very much related to one another on the racial justice and reconciliation agenda of John Conyers. Conyers, as a former colleague, will remember that we had the Tulsa Riot Claims Act. We had legislation for any number of years to create a new statute of limitations so that the families who were victimized by that riot and the survivors, the first time we had the hearing, it was anchored by John Hope Franklin, whose family was from Tulsa. And we actually had a number of individuals who were past the age of 100 come and testify that at that hearing, who were direct survivors of the riot. The history of Tulsa is worthy of its own podcast. We actually tied the whole idea of racial justice compensation around H.R. 40 to all of the riots that victimized African-American communities during that period of time. And it was interesting to sort of see, Jeff is absolutely, utterly correct, that the whole idea of creating a holiday, which was not necessarily widely known by the African-American community outside the state of Texas. It actually certainly is now, and lots of people even knew about it then, but that was not the main part of our legislative focus. Our legislative focus was to focus on a broad range of racial justice issues and recognitions of those injustices, and what happened in Texas around Juneteenth was one of those things. What happened in Tulsa was one of those things. Then the next thing you know, we were spending approximately $500 million on this holiday, when at the time, and still controversial, to spend $10, $20 million on a commission to study this range of issues. So somehow, curiously, we managed to fast forward to spending $500+ million a year on a holiday when we hadn't really fully surfaced all of the issues related to what happened in Texas and thereafter. So for some people, while we welcomed this, it wasn't necessarily something that was high, high, high on the agenda. It seemed somewhat curious, putting the cart before the horse when you wouldn't, necessarily be able to commit the money to the extent that you were focusing on personal financial compensation as part of the reparations discussion. That's another question to get to, how you even frame the issue around reparations, what you're asking for, how you approach it. to me, again, literally working on the bill that led to the holiday, I'm still left shaking my head about all of that, because it did seem a little curious and that we put the cart before the horse. The one good thing about it, I will say, I was in Brooklyn on Juneteenth and got some fabulous reparations, red, white, and green, red velvet cake to celebrate the holiday. So that was a great thing.
Is this more symbolism?
Yes.
Does this get us any closer to HR 40, to true reparations? Please, Kavan, yes. Let's hear from you.
I think it's very performative, and I liken it to what the city of Manhattan Beach did, in that they decided to spend $350,000 on an art exhibit rather than give money to the people they removed from their land in Manhattan Beach. We're not asking for performative measures like a holiday. We're not asking for just providing like a statue or something of historical significance to document what happened to these folks. We're asking for repair. And the most important thing we ask for when asking for repair is that you talk to the people about what that repair should be, the people that you harmed about what that repair should be. And I'm quite sure that if they asked Black folk in this country if they wanted a Juneteenth holiday over reparations, true repair, monetary compensation, land back, anything that goes into the pot of repair, we would not say we want a holiday. We would rather have that money, and we would rather have our 40 acres.
Well, Kavan, thank you. I think you made it quite clear that this is more performative. This is not even symbolic, maybe lacking in utility, if you will. So, Kavan, I want to, you touched upon, actually, this has come up with all three of you in terms of the form, right? The form that reparations takes. And a lot of folks get really caught up in that. And so, obviously, Kavan, you are doing work with Where Is My Land? That is an effort to provide land restoration, land redress, land reparations. Now, this happened on Juneteenth. My understanding is sort of, in, you know, summer of 2020, that is when you decided that you were going to embark on this advocacy around land return. And so just talk to us a little bit about why you're doing this work around land and where is my land is headed with this in the greater context of the reparations movement.
Kanya, you and I met on the Hill when I was a CBCF fellow. And shortly after meeting, you know, I was lobbying for a national nonprofit organization, left there. And then my goal was to leave advocacy altogether, move to California. And then it called me back. And it called me back shortly after George Floyd was murdered in May. I learned about this Black family who had owned land, beachfront property in Manhattan Beach in the 19-teens and the 1920s. And I was a resident of Manhattan Beach and was upset that I did not know this information. I did not realize it. I just knew that there was a stench of anti-Blackness in that city after living there for a month. But I didn't realize it was that deep. And so when I found out what happened to the Bruces on Juneteenth of 2020, the group and I that created anti-racist moms around the South Bay decided to hold a picnic, a socially distanced picnic, because as you know, we were dealing with COVID at that time, just to illuminate what had happened to this Black couple. And then we learned that so many people in the community did not know about these Black people, despite there being a plaque there that was very incomplete and inaccurate. People really did not know that this happened to this Black couple. And so when I learned, I was like, I want to do something about it. And we, you know, there was a reporter asking about the plaque because so many people made a fuss over how inaccurate the plaque appeared. And she asked if I wanted to see the plaque change. And I said, yeah, I want to see the plaque change. And I also want to see policy change that would deed the land back to the Bruces. So from that point on, I moved in a way that would make that happen. I used my legislative and advocacy experience from the Hill and organized a community and got people involved and testified on behalf of this family. And through making all of this noise, the city created a commission of their own, a task force of their own to determine what restoration of this land would be for the Bruces, because they were vehemently against it. They tried to do this research, and then they realized in this research that the city of Manhattan Beach actually didn't own the land anymore and that the county owned it. Essentially, they were like, oh, we don't own it. We can't do anything about it. Even though they knew that even if they did own it, they wouldn't do anything about it. The county board of supervisors decided to return the land, and the state senator, Stephen Bradford, championed a bill, SB 796, to ensure that the land could be returned to actual individuals because there was some stipulations around land transfer that wouldn't allow for it to be transferred to individuals, but to an entity. But my point is, after that happened, hundreds of families from across the country reached out asking me to help them. So we went from this local grassroots organization, Justice for Bruce's Beach, to a national organization that focuses on advocacy, research, and tech to help Black families across this country reclaim their land. And that's what we're doing right now. Right now, we've had to stop submissions, but we have about 700 families who are requesting help. And at this moment, we are only able to really address 52 of those families.
Thank you, Kavon, and all of the amazing work that is happening there in California certainly leads to what the state is doing, right, with respect to its consideration of reparations for Black Californians. And it certainly speaks to this larger discourse, this larger effort around reparations at the national level. Numbers have come up quite a bit in this conversation, right? How much money is this going to cost? And is this going to bankrupt our country? How can we determine who is owed what? Kavon had touched on this lineage test that folks are going to be given in California to determine eligibility. Jeff, you had some pretty strong opinions in terms of how much is being spent to observe the Juneteenth holiday and how those dollars could be used to provide reparations. I want folks to react to that. And also, some might argue that, you know, Black Americans would be better served if we focused on policies like housing and healthcare and education. And, you know, and that's where sort of our efforts should reside. So, Jeff, let me jump in. You have, I think, the strongest reaction. Well, maybe you all did. But let me go back to you and have you react to just the numbers. And is that a place where we should be singularly focused in terms of monetary compensation, or should we be multitasking and trying to pursue things on a few different policy fronts?
You know, I think this is, quite frankly, the beauty, and I don't think genius is too strong a word to use, of how H.R. 40 is drafted. We need a commission of the best experts in the country to look at this problem. There is nothing nationally or internationally that says that reparations are limited to cash payments to individuals. That is simply a myth. And so when people say we should focus on education, we should focus on housing, we should focus on these other things, who says that's not part of reparations? It's not either or. Talking about the criminal legal system and police reform, who says that's not part of reparations? Because let's remember that most modern day police departments, I'm not saying they're slave patrols now, but if you go back far enough, you will find that many, many modern day police departments in this country is developed out of slave patrols. So I think there is a mistake when people, and sometimes it's an honest mistake, sometimes it's a mistake that's made intentionally to manipulate the discussion. And so you can say things, oh, we're going to give everyone in San Francisco $1 million. We'll never have that kind of money. And that is an argument that takes a number and spins it out of control to make it look impossible. I want to step back. We came up with $3 trillion for the pandemic and to keep the country stabilized. And we came up with that in 3 weeks with discussions in Congress. How much money did we come up with to assist Ukraine? And how quickly did we come up with it? So huge numbers can be used to make people feel like this is an impossible situation to grasp. I think the huge numbers are important because part of what we have to do is to reckon with the truth about the extent and horrific nature of the problem. And the problem is not a headache, it's brain cancer. And so when we treat it like a headache, as a small thing, it has never worked. So understanding the huge enormity of the problem is one thing. But if you come up with a figure that's $13 billion, $13 trillion, come up with any figure you want. Number one, no one says that has to be cash payments to individuals, only cash payments to individuals. And number two, nobody says that has to be done in 1 year. How about over the next 25 years? You're not going to fix the economic hole that Black Americans find ourselves in 1 year. It ain't going to happen. There is no short fix to this. This is the long game. These numbers are huge numbers, but if they are spread out over the next quarter century, over the next 50 years, then those numbers all of a sudden don't look so big. And now we're talking about the repair that reparations is supposed to be all about, that community repair, which is going to include families and individuals, and which will take time. So I think don't look at the huge numbers as, oh, this is impossible. Look at the huge numbers as we really screwed this up, and it's going to take a lot to fix what we broke.
Thanks, Jeff. Really appreciate that reflection. Keenan, something that Jeff touched on was, right, we don't have to think about this in a very singular way. And given the work that you do day to day, as you said, a former colleague, so I know what you're doing day to day, and you're touching a range of policies. Kamana knows this too. She did the work as well. Jeff as well on the litigation side. But there are a range of issues, if we get them right, to benefit Black Americans. So Keenan, how are you thinking about just sort of this holistic approach to making Black people whole? Should we be focused on this dollar amount? Should we be focused on policies? Should it be all of the above?
I think that Jeff was very correct in that this will take years and it will require a multifaceted approach. The harms manifest themselves in a myriad of ways. Kamana is working on this whole issue of land loss. And because of property right issues, she could tell you why there are some people who there's no remedy for them unless you come up with something wholly separate. We touched on this whole question of Black land loss when we started working with John Boyd and Black Farmers Association. That was Black land loss was one of the issues at base there. I mentioned that first because the Pickford Claims Act and the Pickford cases were in very specific ways, very closely related to reparations, but on a modern day basis, because the people, in order to make their claims, would have to show that they were at some level victims of discrimination by USDA. They were also looking for return of land. And the whole effort at putting together a program to restore people who were victims of that discrimination was controversial up and until we started reminding people that by compensating Black farmers for discrimination, you weren't just creating, you know, an economic gain for African Americans or for those families. The entire community would actually benefit from lifting those families economically. When we reminded the Southern House members, really specifically from Mississippi, when we said, look, you know, these people want to get back into farming. Who are they going to buy their farming equipment from? Where are they going to buy their seeds? Where are they going to buy, you know, herbicides, pesticides? I said, there's a multiplier effect to restoring these Black farmers. And once they realized that, they thought maybe this isn't so controversial after all. That opened up a political lane to actually get legislation through and to get the appropriations through. I think this whole notion of big dollars and basing this conversation about harms and the economic harms in damages is extremely important. And so before I would talk about money, I would actually talk about the separation between poor whites and African Americans. I had this conversation yesterday with someone and I said, look, during the period of Reconstruction, Italians and Irish were held in no higher esteem than African Americans. All you have to do is go back and look at the newspaper stories, the cartoons, everything. They were not held in high esteem. Or you could ask the question, when did those people become white? Because in the 1880s, they weren't white. When you go back and you look at historically what happened in the 19-teens in the United States, that's when the Southern states very particularly doubled down on their racism, rewrote their constitutions, and became virulently, virulently again anti-Black. During that time period, they wanted to try and return African Americans to as close to slavery as you could get. So that created a space in whiteness. And then a few years later, we actually had the New Deal. As a result of that virulent racism, trying to keep Black people on the farm, African Americans did not benefit from the New Deal in the same way that poor whites did. Those Irish Americans, those Italian Americans. The United States, like with these federal land grants, put money into developing economically these white communities. And African Americans were excluded from that. And that created the economic separation, the capital formation issues that we face right now. This is important for people to understand for two reasons. One, there was no New Deal for Black Americans. That New Deal was for white Americans in the same way that Black soldiers who went out and fought in World War II did not benefit from the GI Bill. We can know to a certainty the persons who were victims of that discrimination, setting aside this whole notion of, well, you know, my ancestors didn't discriminate against anybody. No, that's not even a relevant part of our conversation. We know that the federal governments, the state governments discriminated against Black people, and we know who they were, and we know when it happened. Your family, who you think is pillars of the community and always held in very high esteem by the federal government, no, a conscious decision was actually made to help your ancestors out, to give them money, to give them land. This whole notion about your individual culpability is off the table because we know what your people got, and we know who got it, and we know who got it when. So the real question is, what does a New Deal for Black America look like, since we didn't get the original New Deal? This would be a new deal, and it would happen over time in the same way that you actually built a white middle class during the World War II period and post-World War II period in the 50s and 60s. About the time that African Americans really were gearing up to gain civil rights, all these other folk had actually gotten all of this inflow of capital. This whole notion of, oh, it's going to cost a lot, that's off the table. Or this whole notion of culpability, that's off the table. We do not have to have a historical, deep into Reconstruction, pre-Civil War conversation about compensation or reparations. This is literally a mid-20th century conversation. And again, just like when we were talking about lifting the boats of Black farmers, if you actually lift the boats of the African-American community, you will build the entire American economy. And we will be able to be more competitive, and we will be more prosperous across the board. And again, as Jeff said, just like this whole question of basic universal income, everyone said, oh no, you couldn't possibly have basic universal income to address poverty. Well, Donald Trump decided that you could, and he wanted to make sure that his name was on every check. Because remember, everyone was saying, did you get your STEMI? Did you get your STEMI? It's the same conversation. It's a question of political will, though. That's why your question about Juneteenth, Kanye, was so, so well-grounded. $450, $500, $600 million a year for a holiday. Why are you willing to actually spend that or commit those funds to something that is perfectly salutary in that way? It's just a, yes, you've got your holiday, but don't actually ask for us to have a basic conversation about why we have that holiday in the first place and what we can do or what we should do or how we can address the continuing harms that date from that holiday and everything thereafter. It's a whole curious question, again, of why you're willing to pay or commit funds and government policy to some things, but not others. And I mean, Kanye knows this is a different conversation or a different question where I would say that the reason that you don't want to do that, you would rather spend $500 million to talk about something that you don't want to avoid, a conversation that you don't want to have, rather than having $10 million on a commission that would then kick off a conversation that you are afraid to have. It actually makes psychological sense because the whole conversation about reparations is really a national conversation where we have to confront so many myths about American history, dangerous myths about American history that continue to have devastating effect across not just African-American communities, but communities, you know, writ large in this country, that all of these things are tied together.
honestly, I could talk with you all, your brilliant minds, all day. I want to sort of bring closure to this conversation, though, because we only have so much time for this, even though there are so many pieces here that we could go deep around. Kevan, so I'm thinking about a few different things around still sort of this money piece. And I hear everybody, we should not be wedded to one particular format, formula for reparations, for redress for Black Americans. But again, this is capitalism, right? At its best, that is what America is. And so money means a lot. And sometimes if you have money, you can overcome bad policies, right? So Kevan, in that spirit, I want you to tell us how the Bruce's family story ends, at least ends with respect to the return of land. I want you to talk about where they are now. It's my understanding there's some generational wealth opportunities here. And sort of what that means on an individual basis, right? And what potentially it could mean, right, if Black Americans across the board were to be made whole, to be restored.
I don't think it's possible for us to be made whole. I just want to just say something about what reparations should be really quickly. I know we don't have a lot of time, but Jeff was spot on when he talked about we have been harmed in so many different areas like education, criminal justice, like remedy needs to be in all those areas, right? But I think after the remedy is given, right, there needs to be assurances that the harm won't be repeated. I think that is important. And I think it's also important for us to talk about if that harm is repeated, how are we going to hold folks accountable? Because I think people continue to harm us because they don't get in trouble for it. They're not held accountable for it, right? When you think about how many Black people are killed by police officers, right? Like, how are we going to talk about ensuring that their pension is taken so that they are really, really suffering some consequences as a result of the harm toward Black people? I just wanted to say that part. Now, as it relates to the Bruces, they actually sold their land back to LA County. Not something I would agree with. But what I will say is that I can understand the positionality there as they are, they got the land back. Some of them were living in poverty. And for them, that was a lot of money, more than they would have ever accumulated within their lifetime. So I can understand them wanting to focus on their family and ensuring that there is some wealth to pass down to the next generation and the generation after that. But at the same time, this time for repair is essential, right? And I think it's all hands on deck. Because this case has so much historical significance, and that is the first time in this country Black people have been given land back, I think there was a social responsibility for them to contribute in some way, shape, or form to the movement to ensure that other Black people are being helped as they pursue getting their land back. Right now, I don't know exactly where they are. I know they've been out of the spotlight after they've gotten a lot of backlash from the public around selling their land and not contributing to the movement, the Black Land Back movement, or my organization that essentially helped them get their land back. Folks have not heard from them. The last I heard was that they're focusing on their family and making sure that everyone in their family is okay.
So I'm going to ask you and everybody here. So Kevan, you're doing important work. How can folks keep up with this important work? Join in on this effort.
Folks can definitely donate through our website, www.whereismyland.org. We are also in need for attorneys across the country to help our families negotiate with the cities and the states that are willing to have conversations with them around what repair looks like. And then you can follow us on our social medias. We are just Where Is My Land on all social media platforms, just to keep abreast of what's going on with the families and to see call to actions for any other help we might need.
Thank you, Kevan. Jeff, the Who We Are Project. How can folks keep up with your work and come to sort of better understand the history that gets us to our present day circumstances?
www.thewhoweareproject.org is where folks can come to see what our organization is doing. We have a documentary film, Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America, that's streaming on Netflix right now. And we are working on a book to further delve into this history. And I can say that, Kevan, you will be hearing from us, because having people who can talk about land and the importance of that when it comes to issues like housing is really important. So you will be hearing from us.
Thank you, Jeff. And Keenan, what do folks need to do to get H.R. 40 across the finish line? How do we get to 218? What is your call to action for the people?
there are two things that are going on around HR 40. One, there's our standard legislative drive. For that, call your member of Congress. Tell them that they need to co-sponsor HR 40. The second thing that's going on around HR 40 is that we have been working for about the past year or so with the Biden administration to actually create a presidential Juneteenth commission, which would then be the commission that we're trying to achieve legislatively through HR 40. That would allow us to get around any legislative log jams that we have in the House and specifically within the Senate. And then the president could pull together the same kind of commission that we have, you know, structured in HR 40. That commission could do its work and then return legislative proposals and other kinds of executive proposals to the president and to Congress. And then we could work on specific plans of action around reparatory and restorative justice. We hope that in the coming year, I'll be partisan here for a second, if we can actually maintain the White House, that we'll be able to achieve an HR 40 style commission through an executive order, and then our work can continue to go forward and not be frustrated by legislative limitations in the other body, aka the Senate.
Well, thank you. Many, many thank yous to my guests here today. It was so great to talk with you all. This was a really thoughtful, inspiring conversation. Again, appreciate you all so much. Thank you for joining Pod for the Cause today.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today on Pod for the Cause, the official podcast of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Conference Education Fund. For more information, please visit civilrights.org. And to connect with us, hit us up on Instagram and Twitter at civilrightsorg. You can text us. Text civil rights, that's two words, civil rights, to 52199 to keep up with our latest updates. Be sure to subscribe to our show on your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. Thanks to our executive producer, Evan Hartung, and our production team, Shalonda Hunter, Dina Craig, Erica Sutherland, Brandy McGee, and Deidre Rogers. Special thanks to Andrea Crabtree as well. And that's it from me, your host, Kanya Bennett. Until next time, let's keep fighting for an America as good as its ideals.